This is a story called King Beetle Tamer. On the day Orfeo was born, his father died. And a year later, when he was sleeping in his bog oak cradle, an old woman of the roads knocked at the door of the cabin and begged for a bit of bread. "Oh, come in," said Orfeo's mother. "Come and rest by the fire." And while she did, the old woman peered into the cradle at the sleeping child. "Oh, what a bonny boy," she wheezed. "Indeed, and he is," agreed his mother. "Oh, he'll grow into a merry lad." "So he will," said the old woman. "Indeed, and why not?" "He will die in his bed," said the old woman. "Well, we do in these parts," said his mother. "Aye, but not young and crushed by a falling wall," said the woman, "as this one is like to. But if he has the luck not to, he will be king after the king." Well, that summer, Orfeo grew up into a merry lad, long and lean, and his mother turned him out of his box bed by the kitchen chimney wall and sent him to sleep out of doors, as far away from walls as he could get. "It's for love of your life I do this, my darling. A fine mother I would be if I let a tumbling wall stop you being a king." Well, Orfeo went to sleep in the meadow without a murmur. But he was worried, because he was thinking he might commit a million murders each time he lay down in the grass. So before he lay down, he stamped 3 times to warn all the insects and creeping things and give them time to get safely away. And away they scuttled and scurried for dear life. But as soon as Orfeo was settled on his back, looking up at the star, back they all came. "Oh, he's as sweet as a long streak of honey," cried the lady creeping things. "And look, his nose is all over ladybird freckles." "Aye," said the menfolk, "more to the point, he's kind. From now on, he is our mother and our father." Well, the creeping things told the field mice. The field mice told the birds. And when Orfeo woke at dawn, he had servants fit for a French king, the songbirds making music, the butterflies fluttering around, and all the creatures standing and bowing their heads. All that summer, Orfeo slept in the meadow. But when the autumn came, his mother died. And as the nights grew long and cold, he thought, "While she was here, I did her will to save her worry. But she must surely know now that to run away from danger is not the right way to meet it. What is to be will be wherever I sleep." So back he came indoors and slept in his box bed in the kitchen, snug and cosy against the chimney wall. Night frosts came, 9 white ones in a row, and then a black one that left the meadow burned up with freezing fire. When Orfeo went out on the 10th morning, a piping voice rose from every grass blade. "Oh, Orfeo, you are our mother and our father. There's no shelter for us here. Please, can we come into your walls and hide in the holes?" "Oh, with a heart and a half," cried Orfeo. "Come in, come in." And he held the kitchen door wide open. In they flew and in they scuttled. Beetles' wing cases shut with a click. Shrews' tails vanished like bits of string as they tucked themselves away in every crack and cranny. They were so well tucked away, Orfeo hardly knew where they were. But as they grew more at home, they woke up now and then and crept out their beds to keep him company. The crickets would sing on the hearth when Orfeo sat by the fire. And on days of winter sun, the butterflies, hanging with folded wings in dark corners, would flutter to his fingertip to bask in the warmth. The mice would steal out from their holes in the wainscot and sit up to beg for crumbs, whiskers twitching, eyes as bright as beads. Orfeo's neighbours came and said, "Orfeo, winter is the best time to repair a shaky cabin, while there's less to do. Tell us when you're ready and we'll give you a hand." "Oh, thank you," said Orfeo, "but let's put it off till spring. I have winter guests and it's a pity to disturb them." The winter wore on, and on February the 1st, St. Bridget's Day, the year quickened. First, a smell of spring on the way, and Orpheus' winter guests woke wide awake and streamed out of doors. "Now I can put my house in order," said Orpheus. But already the birds had begun to put on their courting colours and to choose their sweethearts, and in only a fortnight came St. Valentine's Day and all the birds got married. Pair by pair they came to Orpheus and bowed to him with wingtips on their hearts and told him he was their mother and father and begged leave to build their nests on the outside of his cabin. The starlings were in the thatch on the roof, the jackdaws in the chimney, swallows under the eaves, and the tits in the ivy, and the robins in the crumbling niches in the wall. "With a heart and a half," cried Orpheus. "What a coming and going! Beakfuls of sticks and straw and hay and mud and horsehair and everything else good for homemaking." And when the nests were finished and furnished with eggs, each mother bird keeping them warm with the quilt of her own body, how that choir of proud fathers sang all over that tumble-down cabin. Orpheus' neighbours came again. "Orpheus, that chimney wall will fall about your ears if you don't mend it, and soon we'll be too busy to help." "Oh, thank you," said Orpheus, "but let's put it off till summer. I have spring guests. It's a pity to disturb them." Yes, even the jackdaw he did not want to disturb, though his nest in the chimney made the fire smoke dreadfully. Well, spring wore on. The eggs hatched, and from dawn to dusk, parent birds flew to and fro, filling gaping mouths of naked nestlings. Then the first feathers came, and still the parent birds flew to and fro, teaching their fledglings to fly. "As soon as the baby birds can fly," said Orpheus, "I can put my house in order." But before the baby birds could fly, the hive bees began to swarm. Now in those days, only straw hives were used. The box hives of today, in which the bees can live year after year, had not yet been invented. When men took honey from straw hives once a year, they had to stifle the bees with smoke. And one wise, wily old queen bee, when it came to her turn that year to lead out a new colony, made up her mind to save them. So, leaving the parent hive one warm May morning with her worker bees behind, she made a beeline to Orpheus and settled on his nose. The first worker bees clung to her, and more worker bees streaming behind her, till a ball of bees like a rich brown seething plum pudding was hanging from Orpheus' nose tip. "Oh, Orpheus, you are our mother and our father," piped Queen Bee. "Give us leave to make our new home in your rafters." "Oh, with a heart and a half," cried Orpheus. So into the kitchen streamed the bees, and at once they were so busy in its rafters, and soon there were white gleaming combs of six-sided cells hanging from thick black beams. And in some of the cells, the queen was laying eggs for all she was worth, while in others golden honey and bee bread were being stored as fast as nectar and pollen they were made from were brought in from the flowers. "Now I can't set my house in order," said Orpheus. "These guests will be with me the whole year through." So winter came round again. The insects came and sheltered in cracks and crannies. The mice came back to their mouth's holes. The crickets sang again in the hearth. The birds who'd not flocked south for winter came back to their family homes in thatch, wall and ivy. And sparrows moved into the swallows' empty houses. And the bees humming among the rafters had stopped. They were all clung to the queen in a sleeping ball. Winter storms set in. The winds roared and howled round the chimney. But Orpheus slept snug and sound in his warm bed, and all his two-legged, four-legged, six-legged guests slept snug and sound in theirs. Then a night came when the quiet kitchen, lit dimly by the stable lantern by the door, was invaded by every insect and creeping thing that had been tucked in the walls, while out of the mouse hole scuttled generations of mice. They swarmed over sleeping Orfeo. They tickled his face, the insects with their feet, the mice with their whiskers. And soon, as they felt his eyelids flutter, they chanted, "Orfeo, you are our mother and father. Give us leave to inform you. The wind has broken the chimney walls back. It's about to fall." In one bound, Orfeo was out of bed. In a wave of mice and insects, a blast of wind blew him to the other side of the room. A crash, a roar, the air thick with dust. And as it cleared, Orfeo saw a great jagged gap in the chimney wall. And below it, under a heap of stones and rubble, his bed was smashed to smithereens. And through the hole in the wall, the chimney jackdaw came flying. He began to beat with his wings at the stones and scrabble at them with beak and claws, and all the time squawking, "My ring! My ruby! My ring!" Orfeo lifted the lantern from its hook, and holding it close, pushed aside stone after stone from the crushed bed till he came to the jackdaw's nest. It was squashed as flat as a pancake. In it, something glowed as red as an ember. Orfeo took it up and held it close to the lantern. It was a great ruby set in a small golden ring. The ruby was cut like a half-open rose, and round it in letters of gold ran the name Rosella. "It is mine, O Orfeo! It is mine!" squawked Jackdaw, taking flying, pecking leaps at it. "Since when did jackdaws wear rings?" asked Orfeo. "And since when is your name Rosella?"
"Rosella's a princess," the jackdaw told him. "She put the ring down by her open window while she washed her hands. Next thing I knew, I was flying home with it in my beak."
"The ring belongs to the princess, Jack, not to you," said Orfeo. "You must give it back at once."
I could pop it in our window ledge when no one's looking," suggested Jackdaw.
"No," said Orfeo, "for then someone innocent might be blamed. You must give it back into our own hands."
"Oh, they'll wring my neck," wailed Jackdaw. "Oh, Orfeo, you are my mother, my father. You give it back. They will not wring your neck."
So Orfeo agreed to take the ring to the princess. He set out at dawn, leaving his tumble-down cabin just as it was with a great hole in its wall. At noon, he reached the gates of the king's town and wondered as he made his way towards the king's palace why he didn't meet anybody. But in the square in front of the palace, he found men standing as close as ears of corn in a field. Every upper window was crowded, and there was not a face in all that sea of faces that was not turned towards the palace. Orfeo was so tall that standing on his toes and craning his neck, he could see right over the tossing heads. And what he saw was a long line of riders, all beautifully dressed, passing in at the palace gates between two rows of footmen, who were all streamlined black and white, bowing away like penguins. "Who are they?" Orfeo asked the man at the window overhead.
"Oh, that's today's batch of princes returning the princess's ring," the other laughed.
"Has she lost many?"
"Oh, only one," the other said. "But the finder is to marry her and be the king after the king. So, people are finding rings everywhere."
Flattening himself against the fronts of the houses, Orfeo edged his way towards the palace gates. And when the last of the princes had ridden in, he stepped forward. At the sight of his tall, lean, beanpole figure, clad in a peasant's smock and topped by a thatch of hair as rough as a rook's nest, a great bellow of good-natured laughter shook the crowd. The footmen lifted haughty noses and would have shut the gates in his face. But when he opened his palm and showed them what was in it, their eyes started out their heads and they let him in. In the grand presence chamber, Orfeo saw the king sitting hawk-eyed on his throne, and on another throne beside him, a bright-haired princess, as small and charming as a golden-crested wren. As each prince in turn came before the king, he bowed and told how he had found his ring, and then knelt to place it on the finger of the princess. Each time she sat and stared at the ring,
and then shook her bright head sadly. The ring did not light up. At last, only Orfeo was left. As he stepped forward to make his bow, there was giggling behind his back. And in his kind, slow speech, he told his story. All the princes were rocking with laughter, and the king sat grim and tight-lipped, his eyes like a pair of gimlets. But when Orfeo knelt and placed the ring on Princess Rosella's finger, it flamed into a sunburst of splendour, and every face was washed by its crimson glow. And this time the murmur grew to a roar, "The right ring's been found!" The princess lifted her bright head and looked at Orfeo, and the smile she gave him went straight from her heart to his. "Father, this is my ring, and this is the man I shall marry." At this the king's hair stood on end with temper. His crown flew up and fell back in his head with a plop. "What? Marry a peasant? Have you taken leave of your senses? Away with you, miss. You're going to the Rose Tower till you find your senses again. As for you, my fine beetle tamer, thank your stars I'm letting you off with merely kicking you out my palace." Rough hands seized Orfeo and dragged him out of the royal presence. Hearty kicks sped him out the palace gates. He went by back ways to the gates of the town and sat down to think. Soon people came running to the town gates to see the princess pass on her way out to the Rose Tower. "Mother," said a child, "what is a Rose Tower?" "It's where the king shuts people up till they do what he tells them to do," said the mother. "I should run away if he puts me in there," said the child. "Oh, no one's ever got out the Rose Tower," said his mother. "It's right on the edge of a cliff, and it's three high walls all round. Look, here she's coming." Murmurs of pity and love rose from the crowd as the princess's litter was carried past, with guards on either hand.
"But there's two princes in there, mother," said the child. "Both have golden hair."
"Oh, the one this side is the princess, and the other is Lady Rosina, her cousin." Behind the litter rumbled a wagon, laden with stores and clothing. Last of all walked two of the palace porters, and between them they were carrying a big wicker basket.
"What's in the basket, mother?" said the child.
"Oh, that's the roses. Red roses bloom about the Rose Tower all year round. When the princess fills that basket with roses and sends it to the king, it will tell him she's given in and he'll let her out."
"I wish I had that basket. It'd be lovely to hide in," said the child.
From his hiding place, Orfeo could have jumped for joy. That child's chatter had shown him just how to rescue the princess. When the crowd had gone home, Orfeo rose and followed the wagon's wheel tracks out of town through the forest to the cliff top. He saw how the tower and its rose garden were hemmed in by three high walls. He could quite see why no one yet had ever got away. "No one till now," he said to himself, "has had the help of a beetle tamer and his winter guests." Back he tramped to his tumble-down home, and he held a council of war with his guests. Clapping of wings, paws and front legs greeted his plan.
"Oh, Orfeo, you are our mother and our father," they chanted. "For you we would do far, far more than this."
Orfeo sent Jackdaw to tell Rosella and Rosina his plan. Landing on the window ledge at the top of the Rose Tower, Jackdaw thrust in his head and squawked,
"Princess, Orfeo's coming to rescue with thousands of friends."
The girls ran to the window. Their faces grew bright with hope as they nodded their golden heads at each point in the plan the Jackdaw unfolded. And when Jackdaw flew away, Rosina helped the princess into her royal robes of purple velvet. She set her golden crown on her head and her ruby ring on her finger. Then Rosina withdrew to the bedchamber. The princess rang a silver bell. She was alone when two guards answered it. "I'm ready to send the king my father his basket of roses," she said. "Bring them up here for me to set in order." She was still alone when they brought the basket, heaped high with red roses. "Send the porters up in half an hour," she said, "to take the basket to the palace." As soon as the guards had gone, Rosina ran in from the bedchamber. Barring the door, they tipped out the roses and changed clothes. Wrapped in a rose-coloured cloak, the princess curled up in the bottom of the basket, and Rosina heaped the roses over her until she was hidden. When half an hour later, the porters knocked at the door, it was unbarred, and Rosina was standing by the window, her back to the light, clad in Rosella's robes of purple velvet, her golden crown, and the ruby on her finger, as she motioned them to take the basket. And they would have sworn it was the princess they had seen. The porters took the basket of roses and carried it down and down the winding stairs. The guards unlocked the door of the tower and the gates of the three high walls for them, and out they passed into the forest, the basket of heaped roses swinging between them. They walked in silence. Then one said, "Didn't take the princess long to give in. It's a pity. I liked the look of that beetle tamer." "So did I," said the other. "He'd the makings of our kind of king." They walked in silence for a while, and the first said, "These roses are heavier than you'd think." "Oh, there's a lot of iron in roses," said the other. They walked in silence for another while. Then the first, glancing up, gave a yelp of terror, and the second gave one even louder. For from side to side, as far as the eye could see, the air was thick with birds and beetles in their thousands and thousands, flying towards them as fast as their wings could carry them. And from side to side, as far as the eye could reach, the ground was covered with every kind of small four-footed creature in their thousands and thousands, racing towards them with teeth bared and the most bloody thirsty look on their innocent furry faces. "Run for your life," cried the porters, and they dropped the basket of roses and ran as if all the fiends in the world were at their heels. And indeed they thought they were. Then out from among the trees rode Orfeo on a shaggy wild pony, leading its twin by a halter of heather rope. He scattered the blanket of roses on the grass, scooped up the princess in a rose-coloured cloak, and set her on the pony, and away they galloped to tumble-down home. Orfeo sent off Jackdaw to tell the king their news. "Well, well, there is more in my beetle tamer," cried the king, "than in all those silly princes." And he laughed at this turning of the tables on himself till his crown slipped off his head. Then he sent back word by Jackdaw that Rosella and her beetle tamer were to come home to his palace at once and have a fine wedding with Rosina as chief bridesmaid. This they did, and when the king died, Orfeo became king after him. And he was a king after every man's heart. Throughout the land and all his long life, his people called him King Beetle Tamer. And that story was by a lady called Isabel Wyatt.